there's a radical disconnect between the content of the gospel and the lives that we lead. A radical disconnect. And we haven't made the bridge available to ourselves so that we can actually hear this content. Do you understand where I'm going to go with this today? I'm going to do a, you know, it's sort of like we're going to do like a ropes course, campers. What I'm going to do is take you through some things very quickly for the next few minutes and help you kind of get a whole different look at some of the stuff that we've been taking for granted and some of the stuff that we left behind in the churches that we left behind. And I sort of was thinking, you know, as I was going through this material, I went back to the old Frankenstein movies, you know, where they come after Frankenstein with torches in the middle of the night. I sort of imagined the Presbyterian church down the road hearing this stuff, and they're all going to rise up, you know, and they're going to light their torches and come after us and burn a question mark on our front lawn. I don't know what it's going to be like. It's all fantasy. Part of not releasing this information is fear that comes with it, particularly somebody who has spent all of his years and all of his life working on this stuff and trying to put the genie back in the bottle. The genie's out now. And part of the problem is, how do we let this information that's always been there and that is shared by so many traditions, how do we allow that to be with us in a way where we're not overly threatened by it, but that we can hear this in a way that gives us hope? We have taken in a culture, an institution, a religious way of thinking and being that's in our bodies, and when we hear information that goes against that, it's threatening, it's frightening. For some people it's relieving, for others it's not. So that's where we're going to go today. Let's do a really quick Bible survey. This is real quick. Jesus lived some 30 years. We're not real sure when. What was his life like? The Jesus seminars spent an enormous amount of time trying to archaeologize and get into the books and the earth and everything that surrounded Jesus, trying to pull together some kind of a story. And if I had a story to tell, kind of in general, it would probably be something like this. The historical Jesus. The son of Mary, a woman who became pregnant before she got married to a man named Joseph. The gospel tells us that Jesus had four brothers and two sisters, all of whom probably had a different father from him. This comes up in the gospels. He always had a struggle with his legitimacy. He joined a messianic movement, probably, begun by his relative John the Baptizer, whom he regarded as his own teacher and great prophet. John and Jesus together filled the roles of Messiah, as they might be expected at the time. Remember that in the time of Jesus, the arguments that were going on with among religious sects, and we hear about the Shiites, and that was all going on 2,000 years ago, within the Jewish traditions of the Pharisees, Sadducees, and Essenes. They were all after each other, and then the Roman government was on top of all of them. It was not a happy time. They preached the coming of the kingdom of God. Theirs was what we would call an apocalyptic movement. They thought that the earth was going to end very, very soon, and that everyone needed to be prepared for this and anticipate this coming movement that was about to happen, that they called the kingdom of God, the reign of God. They lived in a time of turmoil, as I said. John and Jesus preached adherence to the Torah, or the Jewish law. They were devout Jews. But the mission was dramatically changed when John was arrested and killed. Some of you remember this from Bible classes. After a period of uncertainty, Jesus began to preach in Galilee and challenged the Roman authorities and their Jewish collaborators in Jerusalem. This is interesting. James, like John and Jesus before him, James was Jesus' brother, saw himself as a faithful Jew. None of them believed that their movement was a new religion. They were simply continuing the tradition of Judaism. But as we know, the proclamation of Jesus was not written down for a while, and I'll get to that in a second. The person who made Christianity into Christianity was Paul, the apostle, who went out never having met Jesus, but having had some kind of a cataclysmic experience that changed his life. Because he had heard about Jesus and had persecuted the followers of Jesus, he took on the story of Jesus as his own. Anytime, one of the problems with Christianity is you had this disconnected message about something called the kingdom of God, which is open and boundless, but it always rises into a culture that interprets it. Always. So the struggle is, here is this boundless message put into a culture, into the life of a preacher named Paul, who is a very bright man and a very guilty one. So he invents the sacrificial death of Jesus. And because he's been out preaching for so long, it becomes a part of the tradition. The church of Jesus was to have gone to his brother James. James did not write. James preached. And if you look at the letter of James in the New Testament when you get home today, you'll discover he never discusses the atoning death of Jesus. He's got another whole thing. There were many different kinds of Christianities. Paul, because he was so literate, because he was so well-traveled, took over the entire message. That's what went out. That's what people believed. That's what they heard. And that's what made sense to them at the time. And one of the problems now is to set the interpretations of the life of Jesus aside to allow what is within the gospel itself to begin to emerge. Because everything in the gospel, as I like to say, is hidden in plain view. We just don't know how to look at it. Does this make sense to you all? See where I'm going with it? Beverly, got it? This material is really, really hard. And I was thinking to myself, you know, I've really spent a lifetime wrestling with this stuff because there is so much cognitive dissonance that's within me. And I always thought, well, if I just read more, I'll get more of it. The more I read, the more confused I get. And if it's particularly if I continue to read within the Christian tradition alone. I stopped going to continuing education. I don't understand what they're doing. I have absolutely no idea. And there are, you know, significant numbers of us who feel that same way. The church emerged out of a diverse culture with many, many diverse beliefs. The letter of James that I told you about was written about the year 45. But remember, this was not a literate culture. This was an oral culture. So the things that finally grew into becoming the New Testament were oral tradition and from many, many different sources. And as you perhaps know, there might be 24 Gospels. The Jesus Seminar uses 5 regularly, doing the Gospel of Thomas as well is included in this. So we've got books that begin about the year 45, so we're talking 13, 15 years after whatever the resurrection of Jesus is, the life of Jesus, going all the way into the writings of John, which are about the year 90. So you've got this long expanse, 40 years, of collecting material, a lot of it. It's interesting to note that in the beginning, the community that Jesus gathered to himself was non-hierarchical. Everybody had a piece of it. Everybody knew who they were. Everybody was valued for what they had. It was very, very little, me in control and you not. But by the time that first dispensation of this message of Jesus, which was very powerful, and remember, this message was not Jesus's alone. It came from other people also, because you can find the same material in Buddha and other folks. This alters consciousness. That's what it was about. It altered religious consciousness in the same way that those who established democracy in this country rose out of nowhere and did something that had never been done before. It shouldn't have happened, the historians say. It shouldn't have happened. Do you see the parallel? People like Jefferson and those who walked the streets here and in Philadelphia had a big dream and were willing to take a big chance in order to talk about freedom. Jesus was talking about freedom. Freedom was freedom of life, of humanity, of human dignity, of valuing one another. That's what was so hard. And that's why the message of Jesus, while it arose into the culture, didn't last long because the culture said, this can't be so. It just can't be. Do you follow? Is this okay? Do you have any questions? Okay. By the time you get to the last three so-called pastoral epistles of Paul, which were written by Paul after his death, who knows how, it's whatever works, you know? By that time, you can already see within the New Testament that the church's established way of being was in place. That we already had the hierarchy, and you had what I like to call asymmetric alignment, where there's always somebody in charge and always somebody that's at the other end sweeping it all up. It's like the circus, you know, there's a boss, and then there's the guy behind the elephants, and that's real clear. Except life doesn't work that way. It was finally made. The gospel was, the Bible was put together about in the Council of Carthage about in the 4th century, and about that same time Constantine and his group decided to politicize this whole thing, and so the two pieces of religion and culture joined, and then culture and religion just became one, and it all was more violent than any of us wants to talk about. And that's what we've got within the shadow of our history. Violence, manipulation, all that stuff. What's happening now, what seems to be happening, is we are uneasy with that information. It's not always articulated, but it's back there. And you know, we go and we listen to something and we say, you know, this just doesn't work for me anymore. And when I do retreats and conferences occasionally, I hear people that say, we've never heard anybody speak in the way that you do. We sit in church on Sunday after Sunday and we don't hear anything that makes sense anymore. But we don't want to quit because we got friends there and we like the coffee or whatever reason they've got. Jesus, I believe, was disconnected, as were all the great prophets of the so-called axial age, that 500 or 1,000 years around the time of the birth of Jesus. They were disconnected from whatever it was that happened before. I've wondered, gosh, last 5 or 10 years, I guess, how did Jesus learn all this stuff? And I've talked to rabbis, and no one seems to have a hook on this thing. One of the Jesus seminar guys said, I have no idea, you know? I'm inclined to think that the first 30 years of his life, that's a magic number, who knows? May have been spent in Alexandria with others say, well, maybe he went to the Far East. They find records of something that where he shows up in India with the name Josue. Who knows? Somewhere along the line, though, the disconnect that he was feeling within himself had to be satisfied and had to be connected with a tradition that also shared that same disconnected sense. And of course, you've already got the Krishna tradition in India, you've got the Buddhists, and all of these people, the Taoists, all of these people were beginning to search for this openness beyond culture, this openness beyond rules and religion. Jesus lived a message, I like to think, that's like the Torah. He always pointed beyond himself. One of the problems that I keep having with Christianity, Christian tradition, Christian prayers, is they focus on Jesus, which for me, it's okay, I guess, but it's sort of like reading Moby Dick and not getting the content and spending all your life studying Herman Melville. What would Herman do? I don't know what Herman would do. I have no idea. I'm interested in the whale. Jesus always pointed beyond himself. Go back and read. He never takes credit for anything. He's always out of the way. It's always the universe, the abundant universe, that is acting. And all he's doing is standing there in total astonishment. Five sort of complicated ideas about what I find that's hidden in plain view. For Jesus, life operates within a flow of love and forgiving. That's all he knows. The source of the universe, he says, loves you so unconditionally all the time. When Jesus looked at the world around him, all he saw was the unity of creation, the web of creation, the worth of each creature within it. That's all he saw. Don't let anybody tell you he saw anything else, because he didn't. They interpret it to be something else because that's the way they want it to be. That's not what was going on. This lovely passage today I put down into a paragraph of saying religion might harm us because it has compromised the message of unconditional forgiveness, forgiving, within a loving universe. Yes, the culture has to be ordered with some kind of boundaries, but not at the price of destroying human dignity and human worth. Religion has value at some level because it points along the way we need some stability. But religion also has a tendency to split us and set us against ourselves with unnecessary judgment. Religion fails to understand and embrace evil as a part of human life. Instead, religion creates an external structure to deal with evil by judging it and giving it names. And in creating that structure, hides religion's own shortcomings. It's sort of like the Wizard of Oz. Pay no attention to that man behind the drape. Today we read that prayer is a private matter. Transformation of life happens in silence. Any of you, I mean, there's a, some here are old enough to remember midlife. Or you're about to go into it. Or like me, I think I went into midlife when I was about 18. But we look for transformation. We look for change as long as we can manage and control all that. That's very religious and very cultural. Transformation comes from within. And a lot of us in this room have lived through enough to realize that that's how it operates. Sure, we gather in everything we can to try to stay comfortable, but at some point it ain't going to work anymore. And the gospel directly says that's where prayer is. It's placing oneself in silence before transformation. He also says there are teachers, but they should be left aside when they're no longer useful. Beware of anybody who tells you they know everything. The reign of the divine, Jesus says, is within you, and you alone have the power to see it and to claim it for yourself. Point four, life is lawful and complete just the way it is right now in this moment. Consider the lilies of the field. Life is complete and lawful in this moment. We suffer because we want it to be different than it is right now. We don't know what's here. We're frightened of it. And we can't surrender to it. There's always enough, no matter what you think is going on. If we want more, we aren't seeing what's here. Our attachments cause us pain, he says, no matter how worthy you think they are. Don't cling to anything. Let go of the steering wheel. Once we understand this, he says, you can't turn back. The hand goes to the plow. And the vision will change our life. The dream of our personal desires will end, and we are alive totally in the present moment. Resentment and guilt are part of the past. We don't go there again. Fear and hope in the future will hold us back. These feelings are part of our own personal drama and not a part of life as it's unfolding in this moment. Are you with me? Nobody's glazing over yet. I've taught long enough to watch people go, oh, this is... I know the chairs aren't great. You know, talk to somebody. But it's all right. We'll get new ones sometime. Finally, I want to talk a little bit about suffering because a third of the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, deal with the passion and death of Jesus. And they're really only about surrender and what it means to empty out my life. Stop fighting what I know I can't win. Acknowledge what's here. Do the best I can to relax around it. Let it flow through me, because that's really what baptism is about. Be aware that something will die in my body because I'm trying to hold on to everything. This is not about new ideas or feeling better. This is about an encounter with the healing power of the universe by whatever name we call it. That's what the crucifixion is. We are met and embraced by the loving mystery, the source itself. It is unfolding, and we give ourselves to it. This is basic spiritual teaching from all traditions. I believe that Jesus would tell us that we might be left with a lighter sense of what life is really like. There's nothing to win, he says, over and over again, because there's nothing to lose. Next week, the Tibetan monks will be back in Hampton. I've never seen them, but I've heard their performances are very powerful. Part of the observance that they bring is the making of an elaborate mandala, a huge painting that's very, very Tibetan, very sacred, and it's made with sand, and it takes hours and days to make. At the end of the making of the painting, they celebrate, and they are grateful for that, and then what do? Anybody know? They take it and dump it in the river. They simply realize that their load is lighter without holding on to anything. In the stories of the resurrection, the disciples came to an empty tomb. Remember that Jesus did not leave a set of notes when he went away. He did not talk about purpose-driven anything. He left life just the way it was, which is the way he entered. It was the dawn of the day, and his disciples came and their dreams had been shattered. They were left only with a silent emptiness, because that's the gift that Jesus gave. Emptiness, silence. In a culture as ours that is so extroverted and so noisy, the last thing that we want to tolerate is silence. And that is the first gift of our transformation. Being in silence with life just the way it is. And that's where those people were. And we are told they were filled with fear, and it didn't go away until these people began to remember again and to live again the power of the message that Jesus left. Emptiness is formless space in all of our sacred stories. It is the place where life is continually created. It's a blessed future beyond our knowing, because we live in the universe of boundless possibilities. There's no place in the universe that we are not home. There's no place that we're not home. It's enough. We awaken in this silence to the same concepts that Jesus lived and the culture that we have. We awaken in our silence to a universe of compassion that's without anything but its own desire. We surrender to the wholeness that's beyond mere goodness. We enter the silence and we ask not, what can I do to make myself feel better? What needs to be done? We ask for all to be blessed. What is there in this unique moment? What is there in this hour dawning?